Lambert here, your host for Mac and the Movies. I would like to thank you for taking time out of your day to give this podcast a listen. Today is going to be quite the history lesson. We are going to be taking a look at the game changers and the innovators of the horror subgenre of zombies. The titles we'll be going in depth on include 1932's White Zombie, 1959's Plan 9 from Outer Space, aka Grave Robbers from Outer Space, 1966's The Frozen Dead, 1974's Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, a.k.a. Living Dead in Manchester Morgue, 1980's Nightmare City, a.k.a. City of the Walking Dead, and 1984's Return of the Living Dead. In addition, we'll briefly take a glimpse at the significance of 1968's Night of the Living Dead. All of that, plus an update on the last episode of 2018, and a peek at the first episode of 2019. Until then, let's jump right into the movies. A young couple, Neil and Madeline, are invited to be married on the plantation of Beaumont. While his intentions may seem pure on the surface, he secretly lusts for Madeline and wants her for himself. Beaumont seeks to use the voodoo mastery of Murder Legendre to make Madeline bend to his will. Murder gives Beaumont a poison to slip in her drink to begin the zombification process. Madeline ingests the poison and seems to be dead. This drives Neil into an alcohol-fueled depression. Now a zombie, Madeline goes to Murder's plantation so she can be under the control of Beaumont, but it turns out Murder has his own agenda with Madeline. While drinking one night, Neil sees Madeline wandering by the caves. He goes to her crypt to find it empty. He consults a local missionary, Dr. Brunner, who is aware of Murder's voodoo abilities and his army of zombies. Both men plan on sneaking into Murder's castle to save Madeline. At the same time, Beaumont is having second thoughts about Madeline as a zombie. Her dead gaze was no match for her charms when she was of her own mind and body. Anticipating this change of heart, Murder tricks Beaumont into taking the zombie potion. Can Beaumont redeem himself for his ill-thought actions? Will Neil and Dr. Brunner save Madeline? This is the one, folks. This is the film that first gave us the zombie and in its traditional context. White Zombie laid the foundation for the zombie movies that would follow throughout the 1930s and 1940s. Notable examples include 1941's King of the Zombies and 1943's I Walked with a Zombie. You have the eerie atmosphere, the ominous zombies that are doing the bidding of their master, as well as the master controlling the zombies. The use of zombies were a subtle means to comment on the slave trade. White Zombie came out the year after Lugosi's star-making turn as Count Dracula for Universal Studios. This aspect paved the way for its impressive success, despite being independent and without the backing of a major studio. The film was shot on the Universal backlot as well as the RKO Studios. Lugosi's makeup as Murder Legendre was the work of Jack Pierce. Pierce was an icon of the Universal horror films of the 1930s and 1940s. He was instrumental in the creations of the Frankenstein monster makeup and the Wolfman makeup. His skills shouldn't be a surprise since he learned under the mentorship of the one and only Lon Chaney Sr. Looking at the actual makeup for Murder justifies comparisons to one of Batman's greatest villains, the infamous Ra's al Ghul. Director Victor Halperin had a less than two-decade career as a film director, mainly in silent pictures. With 1930s Party Girl, he transitioned to talkies. White Zombie and the 1936 sequel, Revolt of the Zombies, would be his best-known films. The same could be said for writer Garnett Weston, only he wouldn't return for Revolt of the Zombies. The film was released in the midst of Bela Lugosi's peak marketability and stardom. He did Dracula the previous year for Universal, That is, after playing Dracula on the Broadway stage and for a touring production as well. In this brief period, Lugosi also appeared in the 1932 adaptation of Poe's Murders in the Rue Morgue, Island of Lost Souls, The Black Cat, and The Raven. We'll talk more about Lugosi later on in this episode. John Huron and Madge Bellamy play the couple to be wed, Neil and Madeline. Both were frequently featured in silent films and adapted to talking films. Joseph Cawthorne as Dr. Brunner is essentially the film's version of Dr. Van Helsing. Robert Fraser plays the conniving Beaumont. Frederick Peters plays the most famous of murder's zombies, Chauvin, and this would be one of the last films in his acting career. White Zombie is worth seeing for a number of factors. First, as a historical first in horror cinema, the film stands as a strong example of early independent film going against the offerings from bigger studios. It helps that this is prime Bela Lugosi owning the screen like a boss. White Zombie is in the public domain, being easily found on YouTube, Tubi TV, and the Internet Archive.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about grave robbers from outer space?
Plan 9 from Outer Space opens with a pair of pilots observing a UFO from the cockpit. Jeff, one of the pilots, radios the tower about their finding. As soon as they land, they are forced to be silent about what they saw, as official guidelines state that there are no such things as UFOs. We find out that for a period of time, the aliens tried to communicate with the world leaders of Earth, but they were ignored. They fear that man's destructive nature would not only be the undoing of humankind on Earth, but of all civilizations throughout the galaxy. To prove their capabilities, Eros wanted to put into place Plan 9. Plan 9 is where the aliens would resurrect the dead bodies of Earth humans. The zombie humans would march on the capitals of the world. This would be undeniable evidence of the existence of aliens. You're probably wondering why the heck Plan 9 from Outer Space would be an innovative zombie movie. How did the film change the landscape of this specific area of the horror genre? On the zombie front and the horror front, it really didn't do anything. But on the pop culture front, it remains the epitome of the so bad it's good sentiment. Wood, to his credit, tried to provide a lot of Cold War commentary that was common in the sci-fi films of the time, be it War of the Worlds, Gojira, This Island Earth, and the invasion of the Body Snatchers. Wood would try to warn us of the dangers of nuclear weaponry. Sounds run-of-the-mill, but this shows that Wood considered his film to be just as important as the other previously mentioned productions. Amateurs who think themselves movie snobs like to proclaim Plan 9 as the worst movie ever made and Ed Wood as the worst director of all time. I couldn't disagree more. If you put Plan 9 against the likes of Sharknado or anything you watch on the Sci-Fi Channel in the past 10 years, I would still take Plan 9 from Outer Space over any of those. Plan 9 has a sincerity to it, like that of Wesso's The Room or A Reefer of Madness. It doesn't ironically wink at the audience to remind them that they're watching a bad movie. Ed Wood tried to make the best movie possible with the resources at his disposal. He had high aspirations for this movie, and he failed at a cataclysmic level. Like Icarus, he flew too close to the sun. And it was this car wreck that people kept coming back to. Dare I say, Ed Wood was ahead of his time. If Plan 9 came out now, it would be hailed as the masterpiece of disaster that has been laid upon the likes of The Room or Birdemic. Wood's film career began in 1947, writing screenplays and directing, usually television and commercials, Glenn or Glenda marked his first high-profile film. While panned by critics at the time, it was progressive for portraying transvestites in a sympathetic manner and giving a seriousness to LGBT issues and in a positive light, which was contrary to how the media depicted such at the time. He would work on a few other films, notably Jailbait and Bride of the Monster, before tackling his magnum opus, Plan 9 from Outer Space. After Plan 9's failure, Wood would be relegated to making cheap horror films and pornography. Gregory Wolcott and Mona McKinnon play the couple of Jeff and Paula Trent. Wolcott enjoyed a steady career in television, while McKinnon would have a short career, only 6 films to her name. Duke Moore is Lieutenant Harper, the cop who exercises the least amount of caution while handling his sidearm. Another one with a short career, only 6 films as well, most of them other Ed Wood productions, Night of the Ghouls, and The Sinister Urge. Dudley Manlove is Eros, the alien scouting Earth, and looks down upon humans for choosing to be brutish instead of intellectual. Manlove had a short career, but not before landing roles on classic TV shows like Dragnet and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Criswell. Whew, boy, this guy was a character. Born Jerron Criswell Cunning, Criswell had only 3 films in his career, but a lot of television appearances on the late night circuit. Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, Tom Kennedy, and Mike Douglas had him on their shows frequently. For being a joke with legs, Criswell made one amazing prediction. Criswell claimed, "I predict that President Kennedy will not run for re-election in 1964 because of something that will happen to him in November 1963. Eerie indeed. Before Plan 9 from Outer Space, Vampira, a.k.a. Mela Nurmi, was a flickering fixture in the horror host realm. Her program, The Vampira Show, ran out of KABC-TV Channel 7 in Los Angeles from April of 1954 to April of 1955, even making an appearance on the Red Skellington Hour. Outside of a few Wood productions, she was the old hag in Bird Eye Gordon's The Magic Sword, with Basil Rathbone as an evil wizard. Professional wrestler-turned-thespian Tor Johnson became one of the faces of pop culture through Plan 9. Do a search for Tor Johnson in Plan 9. You'll see fan art, life masks, merchandise, all with Tor Johnson's zombie face on them. This would be his most famous performance in his 24-year movie career. Bela Lugosi makes another appearance in this episode, having been previously discussed during the high point of his career in the early 1930s for White Zombie. 2 decades later, he would be in destitute and in bad health. Coming off of the notorious bad film, Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla with Duke Mitchell and Sammy Petrillo, Lugosi was introduced to Ed Wood through writer-producer Alex Gordon. Gordon was Wood's roommate at the time. This would begin a friendship between Lugosi and Wood, lasting through films Glenn or Glenda and Bride of the Monster, ending with Plan 9. With Lugosi's death before production was complete, Wood would use Tom Mason, his wife's chiropractor, as an unconvincing stand-in for Lugosi. Plan 9 works because it tried hard to be a good zombie movie with heavy sci-fi elements. That's the key component. You can't purposely make a bad movie. And because of that effort, it remains one of the key exemplars of the So Bad It's Good moniker. It became an innovator without even trying to do so.
Top war criminals, frozen alive at the height of their power, waiting for the moment when science will free them from their icy tombs to take vengeance against the world. And that moment is now.
Is there anything you require?
Yes. Impossible. A live brain.
Another victim sacrificed to feed the inhuman needs of the frozen dead. A network of murderers dedicated to a monstrous project. Beware the icy stare of the frozen dead.
The Frozen Dead centers on Nazi scientist Dr. Norberg, who has been in hiding for years at his English estate. He experiments with the frozen bodies of Nazi soldiers in the hopes of unfreezing them and creating an army. He has mastered the ability to thaw the body. Unfortunately, he is unable to properly thaw the brain. With the brains damaged in the thawing process, his subjects are merely mindless zombies that he keeps contained in the catacombs of his home. Norberg realizes that his zombies adopt a behavior from a period in their life. One zombie sulks and cries in the corner, like a child punished by his parents. One zombie in particular, subject number 3, is aggressive, actively trying to strangle people at random. Turns out subject number 3 is Norberg's brother and the father of Jean. Supposedly assisting Dr. Norberg is Carl, yet Carl keeps repeatedly screwing up. Carl prematurely notifies Norberg's superiors that the thawing process has been a success. They quickly arrive only to find Norberg's work yielding the mindless zombies. The superiors inform Norberg that there are 1,500 soldiers in reserve for him to thaw once he's mastered the process. When drilling through the skull of a subject, Carl startles Norberg, causing Norberg to damage the brain tissue of the subject. When Norberg's niece Jean and her classmate Elsa arrive unexpectedly, Carl kills Elsa that night for Dr. Norberg to study her brain and creates a flimsy story for Elsa's departure that Jean doesn't even buy for an instant.
Carl!
While Dr. Norberg is bad enough as the Nazi scientist, Carl is the real villain of the film, and he's the one who keeps the suspense and tension going through the film. Norberg calls upon the service of American scientist Dr. Ted Roberts. He's mastered the process of transferring heads from one body to another. He's also perfected a method to safely thaw the brains of frozen bodies. When Dr. Roberts arrives, he doesn't suspect the true motivations of Norberg's work, but complicates matters when he begins to fall in love for Jean. Can Norberg complete his objectives to successfully thaw the soldiers without arousing suspicions? What will happen between Dr. Roberts and Jean? How much more trouble will Carl create for Dr. Norberg? The Frozen Dead is a fairly obscure gem that warrants rediscovering. This is the film that gave us the Nazi zombie, in the truest sense of the word. It came out in 1966, 11 years before Shockwaves from Kevin Wiederhorn, and long before the likes of Zombie Lake and Oasis of the Zombies. I know there will be those who are quick to point out earlier films before Frozen Dead, but they don't actually have Nazis as zombies. 1941's King of the Zombies has a scientist attempting to transfer U.S. military personalities in Caribbean zombies. 1943's Revenge of the Zombies has a Nazi scientist making zombies out of the people of Louisiana. 1955's Creature with the Atomic Brain has a Nazi scientist using Italian citizens for his zombies. You have to be a Nazi to become a Nazi zombie. That's how all this works. The first film to actually do this was 1966's The Frozen Dead. Without this movie, we wouldn't have the likes of Shockwaves, Zombie Lake, Oasis of the Zombies, although that might have been a good thing. We wouldn't have had Outpost, Dead Snow, Nazis at the Center of the Earth, and the recent Overlord. Imagine Wolfenstein without Nazi zombies. Imagine Call of Duty without Nazi zombies. Frozen Dead did it first. Director Herbert J. Letter had a short career with only 7 films to his name. He also wrote the screenplay for Frozen Dead. Dana Andrews plays Norberg and has a great arc. When we first see him, his will to complete his work for the Reich is unshakable. But once his niece is involved and her life in danger, he begins to have second thoughts. Andrews found regular work in B-pictures as well as television. Same for Anna Polk, who played Jean, Norberg's niece. Canadian actor Philip Gilbert plays Dr. Ted Roberts, another actor who found steady work, mostly in smaller roles. His biggest credit? Superman 3. Kathleen Breck as Ilsa starts out as a rather plain girl, but when she's decapitated and used for Norberg's experiments, she gets downright creepy. Dare I say she was channeling Virginia Lee's performance as Jan in the Pan from 1962's The Brain That Wouldn't Die. Although in a very small role, Oliver McGreevy plays the zombie butler. I only mention him because he would go on to play the homicidal maniac dressed as Santa Claus in the All Through the House segment for the Amicus production Tales from the Crypt in 1972. I get sentimental about that movie because it was the first one I ever did an introduction for at a screening. It just warms my heart. Two actors from this film will go on to bigger and better things. Edward Fox, who played subject number 3, would go on to play the title character in the political thriller, The Day of the Jackal. He was even in the recent Johnny English Strikes Back. Good for him. Then you have Alan Tilvern. Anyone in my age group will immediately recognize him as R.K. Maroon, the CD producer in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Given how much Nazi zombies have played a role in pop culture, more credit should be bestowed upon the Frozen Dead. There's some good talent, an intriguing plot, and a tension that grows as the film goes on. You can find the full movie on YouTube, and it is well, well worth your time. Discussing an episode on the influential zombie movies, you can't go without bringing up the Romero classic Night of the Living Dead. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I do plan on an episode looking at the six zombie movies he directed. When Night of the Living Dead was unleashed in 1968, Romero changed the zombie movie. Granted, they were referred to as ghouls at the time. Zombie was not a term used by Romero until 1978's Dawn of the Dead, but that's besides the point. Up until then, zombies were primarily isolated in their Caribbean origins or were the subjects of evil experiments from mad scientists. Zombies in this manner were more figures of camp horror than seen as an unrelenting menace. In the wake of Night of the Living Dead, the zombies were no longer just dead-eyed servants that were an allegory for slavery. The zombies were no longer strangers in a strange land. They were our family, our friends, our neighbors. They wanted to kill us and eat us. They were figures in a society engulfed in strife, social unrest, civil rights, Vietnam. Night of the Living Dead gave us the zombie movie and the zombie lore in general as we know it. Everything that came after in media of film, television, video games, comic books, The Walking Dead, Resident Evil, Fido, Zombieland, Shaun of the Dead, these are just a tip of the iceberg with regards to the pop culture representations of zombies. Romero made zombies mainstream. Dead at Manchester Morgue opens with George leaving London and enjoying a holiday in the scenic rural countryside. At a gas station, his motorbike is damaged after a car runs into it. The car was driven by Edna. Edna takes George with her since they were headed in the same direction. On the way, they stop to ask for directions. Edna stays with the car while George goes to look around for someone to help them. In a field, there is a new machine that is used to kill the insect population, ruining a farmer's crops. The machine deploys sonic waves that agitates the central nervous system and drives the insects into attacking each other. The farmer agrees to help George and they head back to the car. Meanwhile, Edna is attacked by a stranger. She goes into the car to protect herself. If you think this segment is blatantly stealing from the graveyard chase in Night of the Living Dead, don't worry, it is. Edna gets out and tells George about the man who attacked her. The farmer jokes that it must have been Guthrie, but Guthrie died days ago. We find out that Edna is trying to visit her sister, Katie. Katie is struggling with heroin addiction and was hoping to help her, along with her sister's husband, Martin. Katie and Martin are attacked by Guthrie. Martin is murdered, and Katie is viewed as the prime suspect by the police investigator. While at a hospital, George and a doctor are finding that the newborn babies are exhibiting aggressive tendencies, attacking the nursing staff. George and the doctor talk, suspecting that the machines may be connected. But with no concrete proof, nothing can be done about it. Are the machines truly responsible for the weird incidents? Can Katie's innocence be proven before it is too late? When George Romero's Dawn of the Dead was released in 1978, a wave of zombie movies followed, mostly from the Italian film industry. But that was not the first time a Romero film influenced a country's output. Following the release of Night of the Living Dead, Spain released a few films to capitalize on that film's worldwide reception. One such film was 1971's Tombs of the Blind Dead from director Armando de Osorio, which was the first in a series of five films featuring the gruesome Templars. Another was 1974's Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, a.k.a. Let Sleeping Corpses Lie. What makes this film a game changer was that the film was the prototype for the Italian zombie movies that would follow in the wake of Dawn of the Dead. This Spanish film featured all the elements that would be common in the zombie horrors, notably from the likes of Lucio Fulci. There's the great atmosphere, which was a hallmark of Italian horror. The shocking gore was courtesy of Gino De Rossi, who would go on to work with Fulci. The haunting score by Giuliano Sorgini predates the work of Goblin and Fabio Frizzi. It's a music score I love so much, I had a copy imported from Germany. The film can be found under a number of other titles: Do Not Profane the Sleep of the Dead, Invasion of Zombies, Massacre of the Living Dead, and Don't Open the Window. In fact, it was the title of Don't Open the Window that inspired the Grindhouse Foe trailer from director Edgar Wright. Don't.
60s and 70s, you used to get a lot of European films that would be given a different title in the States. There was a sort of Italian-Spanish zombie film called, in the UK it's called The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue. In Spain it's called Don't Speak Ill of the Dead, which is fine, like two, you know, zombie-themed titles. In the States it's called Don't Open the Window, which has no real, like, sort of bearing on the plot at all. There's no big window-based scene.
You'll cringe with terror when you see Don't Open the Window. Whatever's out there will wait. Rated R.
If you are thinking of going into this house...
Director George Grau made a name for himself with the Elizabeth Báthory-inspired horror film The Legend of Blood Castle, a.k.a. Blood Ceremony. The script for Let Sleeping Corpses Lie was almost a complete copy of Romero's film. Grau offered changes to the script to make the film more of its own offering. Ray Lovelock plays the cynical George. He's not the typical hero you would see in a horror film, which makes him all the more interesting as a character in the zombie genre. Christina Galbo is Edna, the frequent damsel in distress, but manages to avoid the catatonic helplessness that plagued Barbara in Night of the Living Dead. Stage actor Arthur Kennedy almost steals the film as the police investigator. Kennedy was often one of Arthur Miller's go-to actors for his plays. Here he comes off as a bitter man, restlessly trying to maintain the old world view of order. That bitterness could easily be channeled from Kennedy as an actor. He goes from starring in some of the most prestigious plays in theater history, only to find work in B-movies. Living Dead at Manchester Morgue was the blueprint for the Italian zombie movie. If you know people who are fans of Italian zombie films, but they haven't seen this one, show them this film, but don't let on the fact that this film is actually Spanish, and 4 years before, actually no, 5 years before Lucio Fulci's Zombie. And it also predates Dawn of the Dead, by that matter. The full movie is on YouTube and highly recommended. City opens with reporter Dean Miller waiting at an airport for the arrival of a nuclear scientist. Miller wants to ask him about a recent accident. The plane lands, only for mutated men to come pouring out of it and attacking the soldiers on the airfield. Miller just manages to make out of the airport alive and immediately heads to the TV station. Miller wants to inform the public of what's happening, but the military brass strong-arm the station managers into silence. Soon, the infected attack the TV station. Twice in the same day, Miller escapes and he heads for the hospital to find his wife, then get out of the city. Meanwhile, the situation gets worse. The number of infected people is increasing, the power supply of the city is knocked out, the military is unable to contain the infection. The film reaches a climax that must be seen to be believed, and not in a good way. In 2002, 28 Days Later came out to positive reception by both critics and moviegoers. Yet, there were those who acted like they had never seen running zombies before. I know, some people refer to them as infected. To that I say, a zombie by any other name is still a zombie. You had the horror snobs who were quick to remind others that running zombies were a thing in 1984's Return of the Living Dead. And then you had the smaller subsect of horror fans who knew their Italian horror and would bring up Umberto Lenzi's Nightmare City, aka City of the Walking Dead. This film was the film that gave us running zombies. Lenzi himself has gone on record saying that his film is about infected people. Again, a zombie by any other name. In fact, it was Lenzi that wanted the zombies to run, much to the chagrin of the producers, who wanted the slow-moving Romero zombies. I'm personally divided on this film. There is a balance of what works and what doesn't work. I want to end on a positive note, so I'll go into the negatives first. Hugo Stiglitz is not a great actor. He has the same look on his face in every scene. He's stiff as an actor, especially in the action sequences. In an interview, Lenzi stated he wanted stronger actors, someone like Franco Nero, Fabio Testi, or John Saxon. Any of those three would have given a much more memorable performance. The pace is uneven. Here you have a movie about the destruction of civilization. The pacing should be maintained at a fast momentum. But you get the military sequences that shoehorn in exposition and the movie slows to an excruciating crawl. When the zombie sequences happen, the pace picks right back up. The climax of the film features my all-time most hated plot twist. Spoiler alert for this 38-year-old movie. Everything happens to be a dream. When attempting to be rescued off a roller coaster by a helicopter, Miller's wife falls to her death and he wakes up in bed. I hate this plot twist. I hate this plot twist with every fiber of my being, especially since filmmakers don't know how to even make this plot twist work. If you want to make the everything is a dream plot twist work, you need to have the protagonist in every scene. He cannot be left out at any moment if you're going to try this plot twist. Now, what did I like about this film? The performances by both Mel Ferrer and Francisco Rabal bring much-needed credibility to the film. Ferrer was a staple supporting actor in old Hollywood before settling on television and exploitation. Same for Rabal, but he was more the Spanish cinema equivalent. One of Rabal's last roles would be for Stuart Gordon's Dagon. On the stunt front, we actually have a pair of Dell'Acquas in the film. Roberto Dell'Acqua plays a random zombie, while Octaviano plays a zombie outside of the TV station. For those who may not remember from our Bud Spencer and Terrence Hill episode, the Dell'Acquas were a quartet of brothers who all went into being stuntmen in an Italian film. We have two of the brothers in this film right here. There were moments of absurdity that added to my enjoyment of the film. When zombies are invading an operating room, a doctor throws a scalpel like a Comanche throwing a tomahawk. Maybe someone can tell me at what point in medical school do they learn how to throw scalpels like that. Miller uses an unplugged television that explodes upon impact for some reason. The music score by Stelvio Cipriani remains one of my favorite horror scores. The opening credits music I played at the start of this review sets the tone. When the zombie stuff starts happening, Cipriani kicks up the pace, giving us music that just has the right sense of chaos on screen. gore in this movie is not as heavy as in other Lindsay films, especially Make Them Die Slowly, a.k.a. Cannibal Ferox. But this has some cannibal-caliber violence. A guy gets his head completely cut off with a zombie drinking blood right out of his neck stump. A woman gets one of her breasts sliced off. These moments are few and far between, which ends up making them more effective. Nightmare City undoubtedly has its place in zombie horror. It's a mixed bag that will appease any horror fan, but some of the negatives are too much to look past. Your mileage may vary with this one. Imagine, if you will, Night of the Living Dead was based on a real incident. The military was able to clean up the situation and keep it under wraps. The incident remains a secret very few know about. Unfortunately, some of the barrels containing the contaminated corpses have been scattered about all over the country. At a mortician's warehouse, a foreman tells his assistant about the barrels and their urban legend. The foreman then shows the assistant an actual barrel. The foreman accidentally releases the contents. They pass out from the noxious fumes, but not before the body in the barrel reanimates. When the duo regain consciousness, they call their boss. They inform him of the situation. First, they try to kill the brain, and that doesn't work.
I thought you said if we destroyed the brain, it'd die.
It worked in the movie!
Well, it ain't working now, Frank.
I mean the movie line!
They proceed to chop the body up and carry the pieces to a nearby mortuary, hoping to burn the remains and solve their problem. But this only makes the situation worse. The contaminated ashes of the zombie mix with the rain clouds. So here we have this contaminated rain hitting the ground. For the living, they experience skin irritation, but the rain also brings the dead back to life. Any attempts to contain the situation fail as the zombie menace spreads to neighboring areas. Before Return of the Living Dead, zombies were strictly flesh-eaters and gut-munchers. With Return of the Living Dead, this was the first time they had a hunger for brains. And with that, we have all of this brain-related zombie-eating lore coming about. Jonathan Coulton's RE Your Brains.
All we want to do is eat your brains. We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
The zombie folk singer commercial in You Don't Know Jack, Dial Z for Zombies from the Simpsons Halloween Special 3, Zombie Charity Walks for Brain Cancer Studies, Collecting the Brains in the Borderlands DLC of Zombie Island of Dr. Ned, numerous birthday card graphics, and others owe their existence to this film. By the mid-1980s, zombies were as plentiful as they are now, and their welcome just as worn out. The Italian zombie craze was showing signs of fading. Around this time, Romero brought his Dead trilogy to a close, by all appearances, with Day of the Dead. Reanimator was a Frankenstein spin on the zombie mythos. What more could be done by this point? Leave it to Dan O'Bannon, the writer of John Carpenter's Dark Star and Ridley Scott's Alien, to bring new life to the living dead. O'Bannon took the story conceived by Night of the Living Dead alumni John Russo, Russ Striner, and Rudy Ritchie, and altered it into the zombie comedy we love to this day. O'Bannon had a knack for implementing biology and technology into his films. His experience with Crohn's disease was the inspiration for the chestburster in Aliens. Dark Star and Blue Thunder were warnings of the reliance on artificial intelligence. When Return of the Living Dead was released, there was a greater understanding of the brain as well as the awareness of endorphins. This gave way to why the zombies ate brains.
Why do you eat people?
Not people. Brains.
Brains only?
Yes.
Why?
The pain.
What about the pain?
The pain of being dead.
The cast features no shortage of talents. Clu Gulager brings some cantankerous charm as Bert, the boss of the two bunglers, Frank and Eddie. James Karen has a blast as Frank.
Don Kelfa is also a joy to watch here as Ernie. Yeah, Ernie was his name. And apparently it was just a coincidence that Daniel Bannon named two of his characters Bert and Ernie, completely unaware that they were the same names as two characters from Sesame Street. Tommy Jarvis 3.0, Tom Matthews, manages to be funny and creepy when he turns full zombie. Scream Queen Linnea Quigley and Miguel Nunez stand out among the punk kids in the cemetery. Alan Troutman is unforgettable as the Tar Man. Return of the Living Dead stands as one of the most influential zombie movies ever made. Who knew that a minor change in eating habits could be what was needed? The film works and is still infinitely enjoyable. This is one that is not hard to find. And that finishes this episode of Mech in the Movies. Thanks for taking time to give this a listen. There will be a slight change in the schedule for the remainder of the year. Next week, I will be dropping my Year in Review episode. I'll be sharing my thoughts on films and video games of 2018. Plus, I will have a special guest, good friend and bad movie aficionado, John Cleveland. We will be sharing with you our top 10 lists for alternative Christmas movies. Then I'll be taking a 3-week break for Christmas and New Year. The first episode for Making the Movies for 2019 will drop on January 11th. That's still a Friday. There, for that episode, I will be covering the Polizio Tesci films of Enzo G. Castellari. If you would like to see this show grow, consider a one-time donation via PayPal. You can find me on social media via Facebook and Twitter. If you have any questions, you can reach me via Gmail. All this information will be in the description. Until next time, this is Mackenzie Lambert with Mech in the Movies. Take care, everyone.